Hey guys, Mitch Worrell here from Lee Hogan's Building Champions program. I'm 34 years old and I come from Pioneer Bay, Victoria. We had a track in our backyard, which is great. Which is in suburbia too. I don't know how we got away with it. It was mental that we had it there and no one really complained. So our house, we lived in this little bungalow shed, and there was days where we had 11 bikes. We never had a garage or anything. My mum used to have to push bikes out of the way to make herself a coffee. And I'm laying on the ground. I'm just screaming. And I'm like, this is bad. All the guys rush over. They open my boot. And I see people's faces. They start to turn white. Got a nice bill for $35,000 for the US for the trouble. And then this big dude comes in and he introduced himself. I'm like, oh.
He's only got one job.
And then they put me to sleep. And then apparently this guy was standing on me on the bed trying to clunk my femur back in. Before you know it, my partner's like, what's this? And then I've got a brand new 450 just rolls up at home. And then I've boxes from Fox rolling in. And she's like, what's all this? And I'm like, yeah, well, I kind of used to be half okay at this.
There were times I was lost, dark had fear, couldn't see through the rain. In the end it was clear, hit the fan. I was more than one man, who was there to lend a hand? Together we'd stand, always at my back, but got a young soldier. Team pulled together, united we conquer. Blessed is he who in the name of charity carry me when I'm weak, straight through the valley of darkness. Pitch blackness, the heartless, regardless, fear couldn't part us. Thick and thin, there by my side, at times we collide, but in the end we ride. And thin, there by my side, at times we collide, but in the end we ride. We ride, 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 ride.
Are you my brother's keeper? Keep on holding strong, united we stand, divided we fall, together we belong. I am my brother's keeper. Keep on holding strong, united we stand, divided we fall, together we belong. I am my brother's keeper.
What is up, Moto fans? This is episode 22 of the Mental for Moto podcast, and I'm your host, Pete Wolfe. Before we get started, a big thanks to our partners for this show: Graphics by Aqua, SBMX Suspension and Engine Performance, Death Grip Gloves, Works Racing, Iro, Five Gloves, Shred Bike Care, Wolf Building Compliance, and Bolt Everywhere Premium Racewear. Also, I'd like to give a big thanks to everyone that bought themselves a 2024 motocross calendar to raise money for the Mental for Moto Rider Support Program. We've raised nearly $4,500 to support the privateer riders with their 2024 season so far. The calendars are still available on the Mental for Moto website, and it would be great if we could reach $5,000. So if you haven't already, it would be awesome if you could get on and order yourself a calendar today. Now for this episode, we have a fantastic industry guest, Mitch Worrell, who is a coach for Lee Hogan's Building Champions program. We actually recorded this episode in the Moto Asylum a couple of weeks ago, and I had a blast chatting with Mitch not only about his work in the industry and his own riding, but a range of other motocross topics as well. I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I did recording this one. So without further ado, here is episode 22 with Mitch Worrell. Mitch Worrell, welcome to the Moto Asylum, mate.
Thank you very much for having me, Pete.
Absolute pleasure. So what's been happening?
Not too much, mate. Just came off a nice little night shift. Got home at 4 o'clock this morning and then popped up and came into the asylum, came into the studio. So yeah, it's good to be here finally. We've finally made it happen. So yeah, it's really good to be here and have a chat.
We might as well get started. You're our first industry guest for 2024. So tell us a little bit about your role in the industry.
Yes, I'm a coach for Lee Hogan's Building Champions program. I think I'm in my fourth year on that program, which is an absolute, I love it. I love coaching, and it's something I'm really passionate about. Yep. So, and with that, you know, comes a relationship with Honda Motorcycles and Fox and all our partners in that respect. So, yeah, love it. It's great.
So is this your busy time of year now, like coming into the pre-season?
It is, yeah. Yeah, I just did a school at City MX, so I jump on with those guys, with Steve and their crew, and we do like a massive school holiday program out there. So I think we had think there was like 34 riders, as myself, Emma Milosevic, and then a couple of CDMX's coaches as well there, which is a massive day for us. And yeah, it was really good fun. And yeah, it's something. And then I've got a couple of one-on-ones and that sort of stuff as well, a little bit of preseason stuff coming up as well with a few of my guys. So yeah, looking forward to getting into it with the guys and getting everyone ready for the race season.
Yeah, I know there's a bit of a link. Do you have much to do with like the junior development program with Honda as well? Because that's also a Lee Hogan thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So we've got our junior race team. I think we've got three riders from WA. We've got Seth Shackleton. We've got Leah Rimbus in the junior girls class, and then we've got Jacob Sully out of Queensland as well. So yeah. They're all rippers. We actually caught up for our team photo shoot a couple of weeks ago, and I got to ride with those kids, and it's unbelievable how fast they're going. On dirt bikes, you know, it's something that I think if you took them back 10 years, that they would win everything. Like the speed of these kids nowadays is unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's,
and Seth, he was out at PBI a few weeks ago, and man, he's got some style as well.
Yeah. He is unbelievable on a dirt bike, that kid. Yeah. Even for the photo shoot, he's doing, you know, he's throwing the thing flat and fender grabs and all sorts of stuff as well. So it's good to see, someone that works as hard as Seth have a bit of fun on a dirt bike as well, because he can do both, which is really, really good.
Yeah, for sure. So what made you want to be a coach? How'd you get into the coaching side of things?
So with coaching sort of comes into how I got into riding in the first place. So I didn't really start, I mean, we had a Peewee 80 when I was a kid, and I rode it a little bit, but my little brother was really into riding, so he rode a lot, and I rode BMX pretty much exclusively until I was sort of 14, 15, where my dad got me an RM125, a 2000 model, the real ugly looking one before they came out with the current shape one. So I had one of them that would just blow up all the time, and then we went from that to like the Cowie 250F in 04, if you remember that bike.
Yeah.
That was so I didn't ride a lot, as you can imagine, with that thing, because they were just always just destroyed.
Yeah.
They would run for 2 hours, and then you'd be in the shop putting valves in them, or you know, that sort of stuff. So through sort of 15, 16, I started to get into riding a lot, and my little brother was pretty good.
Yep.
He raced pretty much his whole through 85s and everything. I never did. I just rode BMX, and he was going to a lot of BCP schools when he was a kid. And then when I got into riding, I would be like, well, I've got to go to these schools as well. And it's something that I admired. Guys like Lee and who else was coaching back then? It was Bocca, Brent Lambin, he coached me. But yeah, I idolized the coaches, and I really made sure, especially because I wanted to be faster than my brother, who was he was killing it too. So I really like wanted to get good. So I focused a lot on technique and really made sure I listened. And my parents copped it, because I was just like, you need to take me to these schools. Like any riding school I could get to, I would go to. And I think with that, and then as that sort of progresses, when I get to 17, 18, you know, you get the call up from the coach, you know, and they're like, hey, can you do a demo for me? And I'm like, yeah, I'll do a demo. And then I would start doing demos. And then I can't really remember how it started, but I was sort of 18, 19. It was like, can you help me out with a school? And I'm like, well, yeah, I can help out with a school. And then it sort of started from there, and I loved it. And it was something that I enjoyed, because it's something that I really I took it on myself to learn a lot. So I wanted to be able to pass that on as well.
Yeah.
And it definitely helped me with my racing. I started so late, but it was, it was something that got me up to that next level pretty quick by really focusing and working on my technique. So that's sort of how I fell in love with it and started, with the coaching stuff.
So what is it like that you get out of coaching on a personal and a professional level?
Yeah. So it's such a good feeling to watch a rider that you're watching them struggle with something, and you can identify what is causing the issue, and then to identify that with the rider and then see them overcome it and progress. And then, you know, the face, like on a kid, you know, like them overcoming something that they've struggled with. It's magic, mate. It's the best thing. Yeah. It's the best feeling in the world to help, you know, to help someone get better at something, which is something that I focus on it a lot myself. Like I want to improve at stuff that I do. So to be able to help someone through that process is massive for me.
Yeah, and as we sort of, when we were talking off air, you said it kind of relates to real life as well, like away from the motorcycle, like having a challenge, having a goal and overcoming that.
So. Yeah, which is something that, I love, anything challenging anytime I have to, challenge myself with something. It's very important to me to, because we live these lives that are so easy now. There's no, real adversity is hard to find. So sometimes you have to make it for yourself. So it is good to be able to challenge yourself and push to a new level that you didn't know that you could.
Yeah. So on that note, what are sort of some of the challenges that come with being a coach?
Oh, there's some challenges for sure. I think it's more, sometimes it can be, trying to, if it's muddy and you got to, get everyone over the hill of like, we're going to get muddy today. Or, if a kid doesn't listen, there's a few kids that, you try to engage them and they just want to do laps or.
Yeah,
which I get. I get that as well. I understand it. But yeah, that's not, I mean, really like challenges in coaching, when you look at the grand scheme of things, like I get to be on my dirt bike. Yeah, helping pay my bills by being able to ride my bike, which is as a, when you start riding, you think that's unbelievable. Like to be in a position where you get to actually make some money riding dirt bikes is unbelievable. To be in a position to be able to do that, that's every dream that I've ever aspired to in riding completed. It's great. Yeah.
And having that positive influence on especially like the next generation too, that's got to be pretty rewarding.
Absolutely, which is very, very, very important to me. Yeah, very important to me to be a positive role model where I can, for sure.
So when you're coaching, like what aspects of riding do you particular, like your style, what do you focus on? Is it like the mental aspect? Is it technique?
I would say a lot more technique as far as what I try to coach on my end. Honestly, when I was racing, if I'm to be completely honest, my mental game when I raced was terrible. I still to this day, like, honestly, I was always scared of starts. I think one of my first races, I was in a first turn pile up. And honestly, I still to this day, if I go to a club day, like I still wig out about it. Like it freaks me out. Like,
and that's so common. Like,
oh, it's massive. I think if you asked a lot of racers that can't get a start, 100%. If you put them on a lie detector test, they will be scared.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. Like, it's something that we talk about, like, in the vet class all the time. Like, we'll talk about it on the line. And so many of the vets, even the guys that have raced, for 30 years, 40 years even, they're terrified of the starts. And it's weird because for me, it's actually one of my favorite parts of the race. So I can't relate to that, but it seems to be really, really common. Like, I love it. Like, I love the start. It's the most exciting part of the race, but I've never been involved in a pile up. So,
mate, you've been pretty lucky then. Sounds like it. But you're the type of nut job that'd do well. Like, it's you have to be at some point, you have to be okay with just going, well, I'm trusting all these people not to injure me, but yeah, it's one of the most, I can't imagine in sports there's anything more scary than, 40 guys all lined up going into a first turn. Like, imagine if they did that with Formula One it would be mental. Like, it's mental when they do two at a time.
And it's funny you say that because racing as a kid, that was something that I actually forgot, is how close you are to the guy next to you, especially now we're on big bikes. Like, you've got 4 or 5 inches between the ends of your handlebars on a line and you've got, 40 guys in a line all taking off at the same time on uneven ground and there's ruts and, so no one's going straight really out of the gate.
No, we're in a very, very, we're in a very, very unique sport where you have to sort of drop some brain cells off at the door when you roll into the track.
Yeah, you got to shut that off, like that side of your brain.
You 100% have to. And you have to, and then the other thing with that as well, which is something that I think in a practice start, I have quite a good starting technique. If I do practice starts, I'm quite good at them, which is nice. So I think to be able to pass that on, I can still pass that on, but as far as I can give you the tools to get a good start, but when you get there, like it's on you. There's nothing, it's on the rider. It's not, you can have the best technique in the world, but if you're freaking out, which is what I would always do, you're doomed to get a bad start. You can't, there's nothing you can do. And then, and I always had it in my mind. I'm like, I'd rather, you know, get a bad start and then I've got something to lean on if my results aren't good, or, you know, this sort of stuff, which is, you know, looking back at it now, like that was when I was, you know, I'm a 20-year-old, 19-year-old kid and I don't know what's happening. My brain's not even developed. I'm just like, oh, that's my excuse why, you know, I should be better, but I'm not doing, getting the results that I should be. Just, oh, you know, I just got a bad start this race.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
You know, it gives you a crutch, which is, yeah, which is something that as you get older, you sort of look back and go, wow, that was like a mask that I had on. Like it was this,
yep.
Yeah. And I speak a lot, you know, not to throw him under the bus or anything, but Dean Mosig is quite a good friend of mine. And we talk a lot about this sort of in-depth sort of mentality stuff of riding and even the image that you sort of portray. And it's something that I always did when I was younger. I had an idea that I, you know, should be doing better than I am, but really I'm doing as good as I deserve. Like if.
For the work you put in or?
Yeah, for sure. For the work I was putting in, it wasn't.
Yep.
Good. It wasn't good enough. Like, and the thing is as well, like I would, you know, even with racing, like we'd go away to these 2-day opens and I would go out the night before and, you know, go to a bar or, you know, this is not now. I literally don't drink at all now. Fully straight, straight as it gets. Don't drink, you know, I'm a lunatic now, but back then I would go to a bar and then get back to the hotel room at, you know, 2 a.m. and sleep and then wake up in the morning and feel terrible. Like, oh, I just feel no good today. And it's like, well, of course you don't feel good today. It's like a self-sabotage thing, which is, yeah, something as I get older, I look back and I go, man, I could have, you know, if I could put my brain on now that I had, you know, if I could put my old brain on my young body, you know, it would have been a much, much different story with my racing career. I mean, I'm so happy that I almost did that because I could focus on coaching, but with my racing career, it could have been a lot better. I think I'd like to think I have some sort of natural ability on a dirt bike.
Having seen you ride, you definitely do have some sort of natural ability on a dirt bike for sure.
Yeah. But, so it's just interesting to look back at that sort of stuff and you know, get into to the mental side of it as to why, you know, you had these sorts of image sort of thing. I don't know.
Yeah. And look, I've spoken to other coaches as well. And I really think there's probably a lot that you can bring to the table as a coach when you haven't had it easy and you haven't had the results. Like, so when I talk to Pete Boyle,
yep.
Like he's one of the most naturally talented riders.
He is unbelievable, that guy.
I've ever seen. And he says to me, he goes, you just got to do it. You just got to go out and do it. You don't. And I say, I can't do it. And he goes, you got to want it more. And I'm like, it. And the reality is like, it doesn't matter how much coaching I get, how much training I get, or how bad I want it, like I'm never going to be close to his level. To relate that back to the coaching side of things, like I think you can learn a lot from both like types of coaches. So the coaches that have had it, I'm not going to say they have it easy because they have to still put a lot of work into being successful in the sport. But for the coaches that riding comes easier to, they're going to have certain things that they can communicate to the riders. But I think, you know, for the ones that have battled and made mistakes and haven't had the career that they could have had, you're going to be able to bring a lot to the table and communicate that to the younger riders as well.
100%. I know there's a even been around Supercross this year, last year, sorry. It's 2024 already.
Yeah.
I've been around Supercross last year, like, you know, talking to a few of the younger guys, like Brody Petschauer, who I'm quite fond of that kid. He's really good value. You know, Zane, Elijah, all these guys. It's so good. I mean, Elijah's obviously older, but these young guys coming up. It's so important to focus. Like, you have to do the work. Like, it's so important these kids do the work, which I think they are, and I think there's a lot more knowledge around it now. But when I was coming up, no one really pulled me aside and said, "Hey, man, you need to train, you need to do the work." Because I maybe there were people, I just wasn't listening or something, but I don't know. I always thought that I just should do good without, but then I never thought I'm going out at a practice track and doing whips and messing around and not actually doing motos or anything. I'm just,
and as we sort of said before, that there's an element of motocross in the sport, which is something that I love, that's super grounding. Like, it doesn't matter how entitled you feel or how well you think you should be doing. Like, if you're not putting in that work, you can't hide from the fact once you get on the the track.
You can't hide from it. No. And it's a realization that I get every time I go to a practice track now. The level of the average rider now compared to 15 years ago is astronomically higher. And I think that's to do with, you know, having access to YouTube. You can watch so much video of these professional riders, you know, their technique and everything. You can nut it down. You know, you get a guy who goes to a dealership, buys a bike, they jump on YouTube, they've watched 10 hours of the best technique in the sport. So already their brain is going, oh, that's just how I ride.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you're trying to get people out of the habit of just, you know, all these bad habits that just happen when you naturally jump on a bike without seeing anyone who knows how to do it really well in super slow-mo, high def.
The access to, and I guess the knowledge of technique and riding style and like even the physics of riding an off-road motorcycle.
Yeah.
It's improved so much. Like I had on repeat, I used to hire a video of Brock Lover, old school. And I watched that over and over and over. And I look like at the 5-minute clips that you can get on YouTube now and the knowledge that riders have today and that is so easily accessible to the average punter is so much beyond you know, what the best rider of that era was able to communicate in this like hour long video.
Absolutely. And the thing, and even with race coverage, like you see that there's guys filming at a supercross and they're just zoomed in on Jet's feet and what Jet's feet are doing. There's something that you're not getting 10, 15 years ago at all.
Yeah.
You know, all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's really cool to see the sport evolve because honestly, I thought, you know, in the era of Ricky, James and Chad, I'm like, that's it. That's as good as you can ride a dirt bike. But then you look at, you know, how far the technique has come from there to now, you know, with foot position, all, you know, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So it's so different. Yeah.
And the thing that still blows me away to this day, because like 2 years ago I would have said there's never going to be someone that has a perfect season again. You know, that was something of that era.
Yep.
And you look at the riders that were on the line.
Yep.
But they just didn't have those attributes of James or Ricky. And that's one of the things that I think is so cool about motocross. Like if you look at Jet now, he doesn't ride like James or Ricky.
Not at all.
Or Chad.
No.
And so you can have the same result, but go about it a completely different way when it comes to technique. And that's something that I struggle to get my head around sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I might try to imitate a particular rider, but you know, and I can't do something and because that doesn't work for me. And it's something like, I used to box back in the day.
Yep.
And I always used to focus, I think, too much on technique rather than follow my natural style.
Yeah.
And that was something, I guess, a flaw that in my game that I now recognize, you know, I want to, when I look at other riders, like they are all different and I've got to do what works for me when I'm riding. And it's definitely helped me improve a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. There's not one set formula. That's for sure. But I honestly think on Jet's perfect season last summer in America, winter here, I think we'll look back and that was one of the most special, you know, 3 to 4 month periods in the sport that we won't see for a very long time again, I don't think.
Yeah, especially doing it as a rookie.
Unbelievable.
And the way he went about it, like his riding has just transcended the previous maximum, what was thought, you know, to be the peak of riding ability.
Yeah.
And the things that he does on a motorcycle, like you'd have a way better understanding of it than me, but I look at it and sometimes it defies like physics.
It looks like he's just having fun.
Yeah.
Like he's just rolling around, enjoying his time on his bike, jumping little bumps and just trying to find little fun stuff to do while he's going 2 seconds faster than anyone else on the track somehow.
I mean, case in point there was that sand section at A1. I don't know if you saw the
clip
of that.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
Yeah, everyone's sort of riding it like, you know, traditional rollers on the back wheel and he just hopped through it.
Hops
like
in, hops out.
Yeah.
It's over.
Not even like it's in sand and like there's zero weight to his bike. Like it was just like effortless.
It'll be interesting to see how he goes this weekend after a little bit of controversy with Jason Anderson on the weekend. Which, did you see Jason's?
Yes.
Yeah. What do you think of that? I was, you know what, it's so hard because in the heat of the moment, you'll do and say things that you 100% shouldn't have. But if he didn't actually call Jason and apologize directly, if his team did it and he didn't do it, I think that that's a lesson that he's going to have to learn the hard way. Unfortunately, it's just a bit of a respect thing. You would think that Dazzy would be in his ear saying, hey, you have to right this wrong, because Dazzy seems like he's got his head on straight. Yeah. Like, you have to call him and say and apologize because that was not on. But yeah, it'll be good to see him bounce back. A dry track, he probably will win this weekend, I would think, though, because the kid's just so good.
The thing that disappointed me about that whole Jason's response to that was, when you look at the comments underneath, there was a lot of people in the industry saying, like, yeah, Jason, you know, you tell him, and like some big names.
Yeah, yep.
And I found that a little bit disappointing, because it was almost like they were digging the knife in, you know, to Jet.
A bit of piling on going on.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, like, I think, you know, it takes two to tango. They're both right in a way, and they're both wrong in a way as to how they've gone about it. But it seems that everyone's sort of polled on one particular side, so.
Yeah, it's, yeah, for sure. It is one of those ones, though, where it's like you can't, you know, you're having a battle. Jason's obviously knows what he's doing. He's protecting his fourth place. He doesn't want to give it up.
Yeah.
A hard track to pass on. So he's just going where Jet wants to go to make a pass. Yep. He's smart. He knows where to put his bike. I don't think there was, I saw a little video today where I was like, oh, there's a bit of like moving across and a bit of gamesmanship there. But because the track was so, you know, it was pretty low speed, it wasn't too dangerous. Like, it wasn't like he was trying to kill him or anything. And Jet passed him and left him. So for Jet to wait for him and start and, you know, it's not like he was stuck behind Jason the whole race and never got past him and then he got in a fight with him. He passed him and got away from him.
Yes, yeah.
To wait for him after the track, after Jason's probably displeased by getting passed by Jet, you kind of are asking for some sort of confrontation that you don't want.
Yeah.
But that's all right. That's, you know, you learn in the class, and I think there was a bit of panic stations at Honda trying to you know, defuse it pretty quick.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see how it goes this weekend for sure. I'm here for the show.
Yeah, 100%.
Get the popcorn.
You know, from Jet's perspective, I think what he did in terms of waiting after the race, that was completely unnecessary. Like, he was obviously heated.
Yeah, not a good time.
No, go back to your pit, calm down.
Have 10 and then, you know, call him.
And if you still feel that way,
Go to the truck.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the trigger is it really that serious? Like, if you can wait 10 minutes and calm down and you still feel like you need to have words, then you can go have words, but...
I do feel Jet was probably dirty because he felt like he could get to the podium. He felt like he could get further up the track if he got past Jason earlier.
Yep.
Which I understand the frustration, but it's like you're in the middle of a stadium floor.
Yeah.
And obviously there's 9,000 cameras there. You're going to have a situation on your hands.
100%. Well, it was interesting because one of the conversations that I had with Elijah Weezy, who was my last podcast guest.
Yeah, I listened to that last night. It's good.
Yeah, was about how lighthearted like Jet is when it comes to his racing. And I said, it's going to be interesting to see what happens when he faced a bit of adversity, whether he still has that lighthearted sort of happy-go-lucky approach. And I think the cracks in that sense started to show, like, it's the first sign of him being under pressure.
Yeah, well, Pete, it's easy to be lighthearted when you're winning everything.
100%, yeah.
Very, very easy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a couple of bad weeks and a little bit of a points gap, and the pressure starts coming on. So, but, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think he'll bounce back. He's that good on a dirt bike. I think he'll bounce back. There'll be no issues. On that end, this will be a little blip in the road for him. But, yeah, it's good to see Hunter and Jet, you know, representing Australia. Because, honestly, I didn't think after Chad Reed, I'm like, I don't know if we're going to have anyone be able to hold the torch like that.
Well, there's an interesting question. Like, I think after, if you look back at the perfect season, I think that was five, or if you include the Super Motocross Championship, that's six straight titles, even though some of them were in the minor class.
Yep.
Would you consider Jet to be Australia's best motocross rider?
Not yet. Let's get a couple of Supercross Championships in the 450 class, and then we can start talking, because I think if Chad had stayed in the 125 class back then, he would have done nothing but win everything for a long time.
Yeah.
And so I think that's because he went up so early as well. It's sort of hard to, but then it also, oh God, it's, you know, a perfect season's
It's only been done before by the two greatest riders.
Yeah, it's nothing to turn your nose up at. So it's a very good discussion. It's interesting to talk. I know, you know, Chad was racing until he was 38 odd, yep. And Jet's 20.
Yeah.
So it's hard to, without that, yeah, you know, without that staying power, you know, it's hard to say without a staying. But Jet has one 450 win and Chad has 40 something.
Yeah.
So let's get to 40 odd.
Yeah, yeah. It's obviously a subjective discussion. There is no
very subjective
right answer. I think in terms of skill level, I think he's on a level that we haven't seen before from any Australian rider, and he's definitely up there in being one of the most skillful riders. But yeah, results, he's still got a little way to go.
Just got to get time under his belt, and he'll get there.
And hopefully, you know, he has a relatively smooth career like that in terms of injury and and that maturity that he showed early, he can carry on through the rest of his career and put this weekend, the last weekend behind him.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. We'll be back to some normalcy this weekend, I think. So, yeah, it'll be good.
Yeah. So, as well as your coaching, I understand you did a bit of work with Firepower Honda. So, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, so between sort of 2017 and 2021, I still do have quite a good relationship with Yuriev Konski. He would help me out wherever he could to keep me riding and that sort of stuff as well. You know, parts and that's just, you know, anything I needed, he was my go to guy from that time, which is a great help with my coaching. I was running my own program then and riding as well. He's one of those guys that, you know, some people give him a bad rap here and there, but honestly, to me, he's been nothing but an absolute stand-up, legendary, a great friend to me, and someone that I would, you know, if he ever needed a favor, I'm happy to, I'd do it, I'd drop in and help the guy. So when it came to him starting his team in America, Firepower Honda, which was Penrite Honda back then, I believe, it's still Penrite Honda, we sort of discussed, and I wanted to go on a holiday to California anyway and do a little bit of riding over there and you know, go to a couple of supercrosses. So it sort of came to be where he was like, I need a couple of people help me. I'm happy to come across and help.
Yeah.
And I managed to stay with a couple of friends over there and 5 minutes from the shop. So his shop in Marietta. And I went over there and helped Yuriev and the team sort of set up the truck, get everything sorted, help the guys on for the first two rounds and the month leading up to that. So it was really, really good. A lot of big days of work. Just with setting everything up. You know, you're starting from scratch in a different country. It's a big deal. So I was happy to lend a small helping hand in that and you know, created really good relationships with Nathan Alexander, who's Max Anstey's mechanic at the moment. He's quite a good friend of mine. Got to do some work and it was really, really good to be able to, you know, be on the floor for Anaheim 1. It was something very, very special and something I won't forget, so, you know, to be on the floor there. And then also with that, because it was a 2020 season, I was actually at St. Louis on the floor for Kenny's first win back after his arm injuries.
Yeah.
So, and that was one of the most electric feelings, you know, being on the floor for that was unbelievable to see Kenny win, especially with Honda, and to be, you know, part of the Honda program. It was huge. It was huge result, and really, really cool. And I'm a massive Ken Roczen fan. He's probably my favorite rider. He's my guy. So
I got the sign. I was born in Germany, so there's an extra reason to like Kenny. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. No, massive Ken Roczen fan. So really, really cool to see that.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, in terms of Yuriev, like last year, as everyone listening will know, it was my first year sort of doing the media stuff for motocross, and I've always found him to be like so generous with his time. He's upfront, he's open, he's honest, like when you interview him.
A great interview, yeah.
Yeah, and there's been times where I asked him for an interview and he said, like, I'm busy at the moment, can you come back? And he'll look at his watch and say, can you come back in 45 minutes?
Yep.
And I'll say, yeah, no worries. And 45 minutes later, I'll come back and he's waiting. Like, he's ready to go and, you know, so he's true to his word, whereas that's other people might just disappear.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah. Looking at their effort, or having seen their effort in the US, how does that sort of compare to what you've seen over here as far as Honda's effort? And what are the main similarities and differences?
I think the Urice program here is you know, it's pretty much Dakar and Urice are the two big premier teams. Yep. I think that his Australian program, you know, with the shop he's got here and that sort of stuff, and the States, I think it's a very, very similar program. I don't think there's, you know, the level that he has in the Australian program is very, very high.
Yep.
Which I think translates to an American, you know, it's sort of pretty similar, I would say, to an American program. And the American, I mean, I haven't seen what he's got going on at MTF now, because he's moved across to Tallahassee, yes, where the team's based out of now with Marty and that. So I haven't seen their setup there or anything, but what they had in Marietta was quite good. But I would even say the Australian program was a little bit more better than that, what they had over there, because it's sort of thrown together, had a shop and
yep,
Twisted Development were doing the engines and that sort of stuff, whereas everything's sort of more in-house in Australia. So, yeah, it's a bit different now, but obviously now they're doing the engines in-house in Tallahassee, I'm pretty sure, if that's still the case. So, yeah, I would say they have a really, really good program over there too.
Yeah, and he's handed off the running of the team to Marty Davalos as well. Yeah. So, it looks like that's really progressed as well.
Yeah, yeah, and from what I've heard, Marty's been really hands-on and really involved, and I think it's showing, you know, see Max's rise in the 250 class. He's been fantastic.
It's been phenomenal, yeah.
And, yeah, I just hear nothing but hype over Max Anstey for the East Coast Series, so I'm looking forward to that kicking off. And I'm a big Max Anstey fan, so hopefully you can get some wins and hopefully try get a championship.
Yeah, likewise. Probably shouldn't be, but I was blown away when I saw him ride over here just for the Aussie Supercross and the WSX. Like, I don't know what it is about him, whether it's his personality or the fact that he's a Brit, but I just wasn't expecting to see someone like, he's got, again, an awesome style on the bike, and he you know, he lays it down over the jumps, and he's just an unreal rider, and I wasn't expecting that level of, I guess style, you know. Yeah. It's just cool.
A big thing with Max is his roll speed in turns is unbelievable. Yeah. The amount of speed he carries, like his roll speed is fantastic. What do you say? He's so good on a motorcycle as well.
Yeah.
Just it's an absolute pleasure to watch. Really, really good style and he's rapid.
Nah, unreal. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break just to hear a few words on behalf of our sponsors. And then when we come back, we've got a few other things to talk about, including your time as a rider.
Yeah.
And just some of the other discussion points that we'd sort of talked about in the lead up to the podcast.
Brilliant.
Listen to these ads all the way through, and you'll find out how you can win some cool prizes by supporting the sponsors who support Mental for Moto. Death Grip Products. Trav at Death Grip Products was my very first in-studio guest and the first sponsor of the Mental for Moto podcast. As a rider, Trav wanted a glove that was affordable, lightweight, and maximized performance and feel, but couldn't find anything that ticked all of those boxes. And so he decided to design his own glove, and that's how he came up with the Death Grip Reaper motocross and mountain bike gloves. I've been wearing Death Grip Reapers for about 3 or 4 years and absolutely love them. Ever the supporter of the Mental for Moto podcast, Trav has set up a discount code just for listeners of the podcast. So to get a whopping 35% discount, either visit deathgrip.store or the Mental for Moto website and enter the discount code MENTAL23 and you'll be able to pick up a pair of Death Grip Reaper gloves for under $23. Wolf Building Compliance and Fire Protection. Having a quality fire extinguisher in your trailer and workshop is one good way to make sure that your valuable dirt bikes don't accidentally go up in flames. Servicing the Greater Melbourne area, Wolf can help you out with all your fire protection needs. Visit wolfbc.net or click on the link below and use the contact form, and the guys at Wolf will be sure to look after you. Graphics by Aqua. If you want a lit kit, Graphics by Aqua have got you covered. Neon colours, metal flaking, holographics. Graphics by Aqua are taking jersey prints, graphics kits and graphic design to the next level. Best of all, Graphics by Aqua is locally based and exclusively use premium quality local suppliers for their full range of products and services. They even do custom logo designs and work uniforms. To see some of their awesome work, check out the Graphics by Aqua Instagram page and give them a follow while you're there, or simply follow the link below to visit their website. SPMX Suspension and Engine Performance. Steve Powell, the man behind SPMX, is a former pro racer, a former factory mechanic, and the current 40-plus Aussie Pro-MX champion. So you can trust that he has the expertise to get your bike dialed in specifically for you. And no, bike mods aren't only for the pros. Speaking from first-hand experience myself as an average rider, I can tell you that the changes that Steve's made to my bike have not only made it handle better, but also resulted in me having far less of those oh shit moments and fatiguing less as well. So whether it's setting up your suspension and chassis to suit your speed and type of riding, remapping your ECU, to getting the best performance out of your motor, SPMX is your one-stop shop. To learn more about all of the great services available at SPMX, simply click on the link below and let Powerly get you sorted. Shred Bike Care. The concept behind Shred Bike Care is simple. A clean bike is a fast bike. And with a complete range of products, from bike wash and degreaser to chain lube and surface treatments, Shred can have your bike looking clean and shiny every time you hit the track. To check out the full range on offer at Shred Bike Care, visit their website by clicking on the link below. Iroh Helmets. Iroh Helmets have won over 125 motorcycling world titles with world-renowned superstars including Antonio Cairoli, Jeffrey Herlings, Marvin Muscan, even Jason Anderson. From the world stage right down to the grassroots motocross scene, Iroh is the title sponsor of the 2024 Gippsland Motocross Championships and even supports up-and-coming local legends such as Memphis Trevina and Zane McIntosh. As one of the lightest and safest helmets on the market, when it comes to protecting my most important asset, I choose Iroh as well, and I've been wearing Iroh helmets for nearly 5 years now. To check out the range of Iroh helmets, head into your local dealer today or click the link below to visit the website. Works Racing Goggles. Roll-off systems are expensive, right? Wrong. For under $100, you can get yourself a quality set of Works Racing goggles complete with the Works Racing roll-off system and never have to worry about having clear vision again. And unlike many other roll-off systems on the market, the unique design of the Works Racing roll-off system maintains a wide field of vision while minimizing the width of the outer frame, so they'll fit nearly all senior and junior helmets. See clearer in 2024 with Works Racing goggles, now also available via the Mental for Moto website. Bolt Everywhere Premium Racewear. Growing up in the 90s moto scene, I love nothing more than a brightly coloured gear set. And they don't get much better than the 2024 range from Bolt Everywhere. My personal favourite colourways are the Blast 4.0 Vibrant Apparel and the Blast 4.0 Pink Apparel. Fully Australian owned, Bolt can even personalise your gear with in-house jersey and sponsor printing. To set yourself up with a premium quality Bolt gear set for the 2024 season, head over to the Bolt Everywhere Insta page and DM Tom to place your order now. Five Gloves. The new Five MXF Race Motocross Gloves have just hit the market. And having had the opportunity to test these out at the local track, I can tell you that they are quite unlike any other glove I've worn. As the highest end handwear in the Five range, the quality, function and comfortability of the MXF Race is obvious the moment you slip them on. Whether you prefer motocross, bush or even road riding, Five have a glove to suit every motorcycling discipline and every budget. Simply click on the link below to find the Five glove that is right for you. Now, to say thanks to our amazing partners and you listeners for supporting the sponsors who support Mental for Moto, here is how you can win some prizes. All you need to do to enter is post an Instagram story of you using a product or service from one of our partners and make sure you tag Mental for Moto so we see it. I'll be giving away a new prize every month to the most creative post. Now, let's get back to this episode. So in terms of your future goals in the industry, yeah, what have you got planned like for this year and what's your long-term goal?
So my long-term goal, obviously, like I'm in a position right now where I am very, very happy where I'm at. I love my gig working for Hoag's and coaching and you know, I'm in a position where I get to represent Honda and Fox and it's something that, yeah, when I started, I never thought I'd be in a position to be where I'm at. So I'm very happy where I'm at. I just want to keep working, you know, keep doing schools, all that sort of stuff. I personally want to improve my riding this year. Like it's something that when you're coaching a lot, you don't actually get a chance to step back and work on yourself. So it's something that over the last few years, I've sort of felt myself sort of slipping a little bit and you sort of catch yourself at a practice track going, geez, I need to do some work here. So it's so I want to definitely keep running schools and keep working with my students as much as I can. And on that note, I want to start doing a bit more riding, a bit more training, I'm working on my own skills, because as we were just talking about, it's so important to keep learning and keep progressing.
Yes, you know,
keeps you hungry. So, yeah.
So do you still find that you still learn from your coaching? So when you're coaching other riders, do you take things like that you learn in that process and apply that to your own riding?
I do, and a lot of the times it's with when I'm, you know, working with Lee or Matho, who's another one of our Victorian coaches. They will see me do something like, hey Mitch, you're dragging your brake here, or you're, now I'm riding a 250. It's like, you need to rev the thing harder. I'm like, yeah, you're right, I didn't need to rev it hard. Like, it's sort of little things like that where I pick up from those boys.
Yep.
And the other thing as well, when you're coaching as well, you're trying to instill these good habits by talking about it. You end up just, it ends up sort of seeping into your riding.
Yes. Yeah. Of course.
Which is good on that end. But, yeah, so I just want to keep doing the right thing by all our sponsors and right thing by our students and be a positive role model as much as I can in the sport, which is all I can do. And obviously, and now being a dad as well, which is the coolest part about being a dad, which my son's nearly 2.5.
Yeah.
So for the last 2.5 years, I've been coaching as a dad, which completely changes the whole thing again, because you look at your students now, not just as students, but you're like, oh, that's someone's son or daughter. Like that could be my son or daughter. You know what I mean? Like, and you treat, I find that, especially in the last 2.5 years, or even before that, while my partner was pregnant, you look at our students differently now as a dad, which is really, it's really cool. And it refreshes it, you know, and it's quite an honor to be, you know, as a parent, it's quite an honor to be trusted with the future of these kids and their riding technique and which, you know, is their safety essentially. So these parents are trusting me with their kids' future of riding, which is massive for me. It's an absolute honor. I love it. I love every minute I get to do it. So yeah it's great.
Yeah. And being a parent, it makes you realize that your position, whereas previously you might have looked at it as a role model in terms of riding, but working with these kids now, like being a parent, it opens your mind to the fact that you're actually a role model as a person as well.
Absolutely, as a human being. So yeah, just, you know, you got to make sure you're eating the right things, you're drinking water, you're trying to instill good values into these kids, which is something that I've definitely, over the last sort of 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, I've been trying to improve as a person, which is very important, which helps with the coaching and, with your worldview and everything like that. So, it's really, really, really good.
All right. So we sort of spoke about it a little bit earlier, just in very basic terms, but tell me a little bit about how you got into the sport, especially like the racing side. You said you sort of started on a Peewee 80 when your younger brother was riding and racing, but how did you actually get into the racing side of motocross?
So the racing side of things. So I rode BMX my whole childhood. I was a skate park little kid. I would always be riding bowls or riding at the skate park, riding dirt jumps, all that sort of stuff. So I found that when I went from the, you know, went to a big bike, because I never rode 85s, I went straight to a big bike. I actually picked it up quite quick, which was good. And then with the racing side of things, like my little brother was racing all the time. So it was sort of like, oh, well, now Mitch has a bike, he might as well go race.
Yeah.
So I think I did maybe one junior race in C grade, one junior race in C grade lights in Geelong, and had a massive first turn pile up first race, and I'm like, well,
great way to start.
Yeah, just an absolute disaster. So that was pretty much it for my junior career. I did one race, got crashed in the first moto, and that was I think that was it for the yellow numbers for me. So then I went up to C grade lights, and my little brother was still racing juniors, and we would just go hit every race we could. And then with that, I started getting more comfortable with it. And then we'll go into every riding school we could get to, because my parents heard it flat out from us. We were into it. Like we have to go to these schools, and you know, and there was this load up the trailer and the four-wheel drive, and we go to these schools. And then we raced a bit and turned 18, and then got my license, and then I had a really, really good group of friends who were really fast. So I was always riding with fast guys. When I was 18, 19, and then I moved up to B grade. And then through that time, I had friends like Jade Zotes and Corey Barata who were really, really fast. And I would ride with those guys a lot. And that dragged me along to, and Dean Mosig as well. You know, we were always riding together. So it was dragging me along to be a better rider. And then, then 21 met Joe, in 2011 met Joe Stevens and just became friends with him. So we were all riding together. And then halfway through 2011, I finished my apprenticeship as a diesel mechanic and then worked till the end of the year. And then we sort of came up with a plan that in 2012, I got graded to A grade. And we decided to go live in America for 3 months.
Were you still racing lights or were you up to the 250s by that stage?
Or
450s?
No, I was 450 from 2009.
Yep.
So I was 450. I went to 450 pretty early just for the money cost of it. And I've been burnt by having KX 250Fs. And I was like, I'm done with valve problems. So I got a 450 in 09. And I remember the first time I ever rode a 450 was when I got it home from Peter Stevens. And I rode it, and because we had a track in our backyard, which is great, suburbia too. Awesome. I don't know how we got away with it, but we were in the middle of Cockatoo, which is not exactly suburbia, but we had like a little like acre block, and had this track built in the backyard, and it was mental. Like you would drive past the main road, there's a track in the back. Like it was mental that we had it there, and no one really complained. It was crazy.
So
we got to ride a lot, which was great. So me and my little brother rode a lot. We used to have friends over. There was days where, oh God, we had the craziest, so our house, we lived in this little bungalow shed and there was days where we had 11 bikes. We never had a garage or anything.
Yeah.
11 bikes inside. My mum used to have to push bikes out of the way to make herself a coffee. Like it was mental.
Yeah.
Lived in this little acre block in Cockatoo. 11 bikes in the house at some point.
This sounds like paradise, mate.
Oh, it was.
For a kid.
As a kid, it's unbelievable. Yeah. As a dad, I'm like, how did you even put up with it? I can't believe it. And the house stunk of fuel. Like the lounge room was like a workshop. Because it was insane to live here. Anyway, had the track at home, whatever. And then, in 2011, Joe Stevens, my friend Kev Mack, who's a really good friend of mine. He runs actually Australian Tattoo Expos now. He's business mogul.
So you're a number one client?
Yeah. So he's so he ran a tattoo shop at the time and this sort of stuff. And then we decided we're gonna go to MTF and we're gonna live at MTF and go to America for 3 months. So the boys all saved up. I went to the bank and got a $25,000 personal loan.
Yep.
Which was probably the dumbest financial decision I've ever made. But I got a $25,000 personal loan. And I went and lived in America for 3 months. So we went to MTF, made friends over there, bought bikes over there and trained at MTF. So we were riding MTF all through December 2011. We're riding there. And then 2012, our boot camp started with Colleen.
Yep.
So 6 weeks boot camp.
So what was your goal when you were going over there? Was it to race in the US or to train to come back and race in Australia?
In my mind, I was coming back and I was going to do well at A grade and I was going to race nationals.
Yes.
Some nationals. That's what I was going to do. So that was the plan. But also, I was 21 and not very smart. So I went over there and spent the whole time riding, which I loved the riding part. They had a gym at MTF and everything, and I would not darken the door of the gym. So I got called, they called me Rockstar over there because I'd never trained. I was just, all I would do is I would go do the riding bits.
Yeah.
And then I would just not show up to the gym, or I'd show up to the gym late, or I wouldn't even roll up, which is just, I think about it now and I'm just like, what do you do? You have such a great opportunity to actually make something, and I just didn't. So anyway, boot camp starts. So we do the first week, all good. And then one of the days on the second week, because Tallahassee's a college town as well. So we're having a lot of fun. I was having a lot of fun at night in this college town of Tallahassee.
Yeah.
And then I would come back to MTF, go to the bunk, sleep, get up in the morning, it's time to ride. All good. So I remember it was one day.
So living the dream, basically.
Living the absolute dream on this personal loan that I have no worries about paying back yet.
Yeah.
And still living at home and just having a good time. So I was over there living in this bunk and with Joe and Kev, and then Yeah, it was one day, and then we were doing a roller section. So we're tripling into a roller section. It was basically just working on a section with Colleen. And I remember I tripled in and clunked it and then had a massive crash. And I definitely rang my bell. And then I got up and I'm like, oh, I'm okay. And then I kept right, you know, I got back on the bike, straightened it all out or whatever. And then we got back on. And then in the afternoon, Colleen's like, all right, we're going to do a moto. I'm like, all right, no worries. So we're doing a moto. And then there's a double near the shed. And I just got a half shift between second and third on a Serra 450. No power off the face. I tried to shift on the face, no power, and step through the bars and landed on my feet on the down ramp. And I'm laying on the ground. I'm just screaming. And I'm like, this is bad. All the guys rush over. They open my boot. And I see people's faces. They start to turn white.
Oh, no.
And they're like, it's not too bad. It's not too bad. And then Brad Smith, who's an absolute legend, the guy, he did the track maintenance and he was just around MTF. He rips on a dirt bike. You'd never see him. He wears the outside armor, still runs a donut to this day, like a Davey Millsaps donut.
Yeah, yep.
He goes, mate, that is, it's done. It's so bad. Yuck. I'm like, what? So what had happened is I'd compound fractured my tib fib out of the skin. And there's just blood hemorrhaging into my boot. So then it's ambulance. I'm like, I'm in so much trouble. I'm like, God, I remember sort of talking and I'm like, I don't know if my travel insurance covers this. The ambulance rolls up and they're like, we've got to get a helicopter here.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So they airlift me out of Cairo, Georgia to Tallahassee Hospital. Two surgeries, the whole nine. Can't get in contact with my parents because it's like I'm in America and my phone, I don't know where my phone is. Like it's just a disaster. I'm finally in contact with my parents, this, that, and the other. They're like, well, we can't come and get you because we live in Cockatoo and we're not coming to get you to America. So you're just going to have to figure it out. I'm like, all right. So ended up, lucky there was a young lady over there that I was familiar with. She let me stay at her place and looked after me for a bit. And then, I just spent the rest of the trip on crutches, two surgeries. Got a nice bill for $35,000 for the US for the trouble. Luckily,
that'll blow out the personal loan.
Yeah. Luckily that seemed to be okay by travel insurance. They sorted that out, I think.
Oh wow!
I haven't heard anything since, but so that was all right. So then got back to riding, and Joe and I. Ran some riding schools when we got back. One of the things that when we got back from MTF, which was crazy, we had to crate our bikes up and send them home. That was the only bikes we had. So you drain the oil, take the tires off them, put them in two boxes, send them back and say it was $600 a part. That's how it works. You don't have to pay import tax on it. So I remember uncrating the bike. I was in such a bad state when I got back. My leg was still torched. I had this bike with no wheels, no tires, nothing. I was so broke that I remember going to New World Honda at the time in Berwick, and I said to the guys, hey, do you have any secondhand tires I can have because I don't have any money and I need a ride?
Yeah. So how long were you off the bike for?
It was actually 3 months to the day.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 3 months to the day I think it was. And then the first ride back was a ride in school with Joe Stevens coaching at a riding school with Joe Stevens at Blue Rock. So, which was great. So yeah, I managed to get back on the bike. It wasn't great by any stretch, but we got back on the bike and it was all good, but I had to borrow tires and, beg, steal and borrow to get back on the bike.
That's rough.
So yeah, which is great. So then at that sort of point, I was like, oh, it might be okay. Maybe this year I'll just get through this year and we'll see how we're going. I might have done a couple of local races maybe towards the end of the year. I can't really remember. And then through the summer, we got a deal with Power Sports Kawasaki in Seaford.
Yep.
To run. It was the first year of motocross athlete development with Joe Stevens. So I was lucky enough he got me on the team. And we're running riding schools. And I was like, all right, now this year, I'm doing it this year. So all summer, I was training my butt off. We'll go up to... there's a track up in Stall. We just pound out motos. I was getting after it. And then I remember one day at Bacchus Marsh, I was there with Dean Mozig. And it was the 5th of January again. So this is the second 5th of January, the year after the leg.
Yeah.
We're there training at Bacchus Marsh. And I just off the, I think it was like a warm-up lap or something, and just got a I can't remember what happened. My bike locked up off the finish jump, 40-degree heat in the middle of summer. And same thing, stepped through the bars, cartwheeled, just bad.
Again.
And then I'm laying there, and I'm like, Dean, my femur's broken, get an ambulance. Like, I thought my femur was broken. I'm like, I've broken my femur, this is really bad. So like, chuck me in an ambulance, it's as hot as flies over. This is the worst day of my life. I'm just like, this is just awful. I couldn't believe it. It was the worst pain. I'm like, this is so bad. They get me to, what's the hospital in the West? The worst hospital in Victoria.
It's the West, mate.
Footscray. I think it's Footscray Hospital. The worst place on earth. I'm in there. They do an x-ray on my leg. So I sort of shuffled off the bed onto the x-ray bed, and then they did an x-ray, and then I go to shuffle back on the other bed, and they're like, do not move. I'm like, what? And they're like, do not move. I'm like, okay. So they lift me back onto the bed, and they go, you've dislocated your femur.
At the hip?
Yep.
Oh.
And cracked my pelvis. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, we're going to have to put you under and get it back in. I'm like, okay. And then this big dude comes in and he introduced himself. I'm like, oh, hey, mate, are you going? Yeah, all good.
He's only got one job.
And then they put me to sleep. And then apparently this guy was standing on me on the bed trying to clunk my femur back in. And I'd already booked a trip back to MTF again.
Yep.
For 6 weeks' time. So I'm like, okay, my femur's has gone back in. It feels terrible, but we're good.
And so what was the damage to your pelvis?
Just a crack. It wasn't too bad. Luckily, it was just a crack, so it was nothing too crazy, but still not good. So I got the femur back in. This is 6 weeks till when I have to leave to America to go back to MTF again, just to have a ride and catch up with the guys and stuff. So I booked another trip. So I was like, oh, I loved it over there, so I'm going back. And then luckily enough, 6 weeks out, I actually got to ride, which is good. So I got to ride at Colleen's place and have a roll around. So it was good, yeah. But after that point, I was like, you know what, I'm focusing on coaching because I can't be missing this time off work. I've got bills to pay. I can't do that anymore. So at that point, I'm like, you know what, the racing thing's probably not happening for me now. This is where I'm going to pull a pin on it because it's just too much. And I have a chance to make money coaching. I'm not going to make money racing.
Yeah.
Pulled the pin on the coaching deal, on the racing deal, and really focused on the coaching. So, yeah, that was 12 years ago that I really decided that this is I'm coaching now. So, and then from then on, I've just been really focused on it. A few years with MAD, and then went off and did my own thing, and then the deal with Lee was unreal because I out of the blue, I sort of through 1920, I had a lot of stuff to do on the house, on my house and renovations and that sort of stuff. So I had a really nice bike. I got through Ureva's, one of Brayton's race bikes.
Oh, fantastic.
So I managed to get one of them. So I had to sell that thing to pay for some renos and some stuff around the house. So got rid of that. And then didn't really have a bike for a long time. I was just renovating my house and riding BMX and really not.
So were you coaching through that period?
Through then I sort of got out of it as I was doing my house. I was like, I'm not sort of coaching as much anymore. I sort of let my coaching brand go, and I was just really trying to get my life in order as far as house and that sort of stuff going. So I gave up on riding for a year and a half or 2 years or so, and then just rode a lot of BMX again. So I got back into BMX. I loved it. So I had a bunch of really good friends who are really, really, the same thing as the riding stuff. I had really, really, guys are really good on BMX. So I was riding with those guys and they were dragging me along. I was starting to get quite good at BMX again, and then met my partner, and then, out of the blue, I'm like, oh, I'll just get a bike. I'll just get a bike and see what happens. So I found on Marketplace that a friend of a friend was selling like his 2019 Sierra 450, had like a black frame and black swing arm. I'm like, oh, that'll do. That looks all right. And then he's like, yeah, I can bring it. I'm like, can you bring it to my work? Because I'm busy. I need you so I can have a look at it. Just bring it over. And he's like, no dramas, I'll bring it around. And ended up getting sent out to a breakdown when he was bringing the bike around. So I was like, all right. Then I just asked one of the boys, like, can you just look at this thing, make sure it runs, and here's the cash. If it's any good, just
get it.
Yeah. So I bought this bike. And then I took it to PBI and rode it. And I'm like, this is the most like roached thing I've ever ridden in my life. Yep. It's an absolute disaster. I hated the thing. It felt terrible. The bushes in the forks, it would like clunk when the suspension would unload. Like it was torched so bad. And I'm like, oh, I can't believe I just spent $7,500 on this thing. I'm like, no. And then anyway, so I rode that a couple of times and decided that I just like, I'm out. Like I've got a bike. If I need a ride, I've got one, but I'm not riding because this thing sucks. I don't want to ride it anyway. I don't want to spend the money on the thing to get it up to scratch. So, and then out of the blue, my phone dings and it's Lee. And he goes, hey man, have you still got a coach's license? And have you still got a Honda? And I'm like, yeah. And this is December 2020. I'm like, yeah. And he goes, oh no, maybe it was in January 2020. So the start of January. And he goes, oh, we've got our boot camp. We just need another coach. And I'm like, oh, next week. And I'm like, oh, okay, I can make it work. Maybe. So
had you coached for Lee at that leading up to that?
No.
Already? Yep.
No. So I'd done schools with him here and there back in the day, but I'd not done anything really with Lee. We'd obviously kept in contact and talked or whatever, but nothing too crazy. And then I'm like, okay, well, I've got this roached bike that's, I'd be surprised if it'll even get through a 3-day riding school, but we'll just see how it goes.
But it's red. So that's
it's the right color. So I called up a sponsor of the show, Steve Powell.
Yeah.
I said, hey, Powell, because I was in Pioneer Bay, local. He was in Coorap at that time. I said, hey, Powell, can you work some magic on this thing and get it rideable? And I'm like, you've got, you know, a few days, needs to be done. And he goes, mate, I'll see what I can do for you. So Powell came through, got the thing barely rideable for me. It actually felt pretty good to ride. So so then I went out to the 3-day riding school with Hoags and did a half a right job. And my partner's like, because she only knew me through BMX. She didn't even know that I really, I mean, she'd heard that I rode, but never really. Yeah. She'd seen me that I had a bike and nothing of the sort. And after the school, Hoags goes, what are you doing for a bike? Like, what are you doing? And I'm like, well, I'm going to sell this and I'm not riding anymore. And he goes, well, I need another coach. Like, I'll call Honda and Fox and see if we can get something happening. I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, well, let me make a few calls. Next week, he's calling me up. He goes, hey, man, your 450 is at my house. And I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, and can you just email Jimmy from Fox for your sizes? And I'm like, no way. And then before you know it, my partner's like, what's this? And then I've got a brand new 450 just rolls up at home. And then I've boxes from Fox rolling in. And she's like, what's all this? And I'm like, yeah, well, I kind of used to be half okay at this riding. Yeah. She like couldn't believe. She's like, you're just a BMX guy, aren't you? And I'm like, well, no.
It's like you've been living this secret life that she doesn't know about.
Yeah, and then she's like, well, all right, what's all this then? And then, before I knew it, I was coaching with BCP, which is something that I'll be eternally grateful, because if Hoags didn't give me this opportunity, I 100% would just be a skate park BMX guy again, like an old skate park dude that would just see riding skate parks till I'm 50. And not riding dirt bikes anymore. So it's really rejuvenated me and made me, you know, love riding even more, because I did love BMX a lot. And I still do, but there's nothing as good as riding dirt bikes.
Yeah. And as we sort of spoke about, it was something that I wanted to bring up, was the influence of BMX on your riding style. We did talk about it a little bit off air, but like you're a pretty tall, lanky sort of guy and you know, guys with your frame tend to look pretty awkward on bikes sometimes.
Yes, they do.
And again, you know, I don't want to be blowing smoke, but you've got this style that, as I said before, like I could watch all day. It's just silky smooth, and it's definitely not typical of someone with your frame.
Yeah.
And I didn't know about your BMX background, but that makes a lot of sense. But yeah, do you feel as a rider, like all that time riding BMX and dirt jumping has influenced your riding in a positive way?
100%. I think it's something that a lot of kids would benefit from, as far as something to do when you can't ride is get on a BMX, ride a BMX track, ride skate parks, do all that sort of stuff. It gives you a little bit more. I think it's like a bike control thing.
Yeah.
With being tall, it's no secret. I'm a tall guy, and I, you know, I always got grief, you know, like, scarecrow tall guy, giraffe guy, you know, all these different things. And you know what, I saw, you know, you see videos of guys that are taller on a bike and they look goofy. You know, it's something that I'm so conscious of trying to not look bad on a dirt bike. It's something that I really, really try to concern myself with. Like, it's very important that I have a good style on a bike to me. I'm very interested. Like, I love the aesthetics of riding a dirt bike. I love filming, love photography. I love that sort of stuff where you get to, like, the expression of it, I guess. Yeah. Like, I love putting together
the artistic side.
Yeah, the artistic side of it. I love putting together a kit. I love, you know, all that sort of stuff, which is something that's, you know, great with the sponsors that we have. I can be a bit more flexible, that sort of stuff. Like, well, not so flexible, but there's lots of options for me to create something. But, the tall guy style is something that it's so easy. If you make a mistake and you're tall, it comes out so quick.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that I really do concentrate on is you know, I don't want to make mistakes on a bike, because as soon as you do it and you're tall, you can't get away with it. It's so glaringly obvious from someone looking from the outside. And that's the same. Yeah, you know, I've got.
See, the first clips I saw of you riding were on Instagram, and I actually didn't. I did not click at all that you were tall. Like, when I watched those clips, and it wasn't until, I think it was the photo you posted of the team, the BCP team, that I actually went, "Geez, he's pretty tall." And then obviously I met you after, and but I didn't click when I saw the footage of you riding.
That makes me so happy. That's probably the best compliment anyone could give me for my riding. I really appreciate it. Yeah, it's something I definitely work on, and I love it. I love messing around, trying to look cool on a dirt bike, like doing like a, you know, one-legged whips, all that sort of like fun stuff. It's fun to try look cool, and that's a big influence from, you know, guys like Justin Bogle's a big guy that I look to for style, because he's a little bit taller. Hanson's not tall, but he's actually a good friend of mine. And that guy, I don't want to blow smoke because he's the worst dude alive, but his style on a dirt bike is something that I really try to look up to. I don't look up to him because he's a bit of a douche, but he's
on a bike
with love. Yeah. No, but he's a guy that I definitely try to emulate where I can, because, you know, that guy's unbelievable on a bike, and it's
insane,
cool to have
natural talent. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Something that I definitely, natural talent's not something I have. I definitely have had to work at my talent, but I'll try to take it. I'll work on having natural talent, I guess, is the way you go with it.
Unreal. So getting on to the mental health side of the podcast, like, I sent out a prep sheet, and one of the things that you responded with was that motocross as a whole, it damaged your mental health and self-worth back in the day.
100%.
Yeah, so I wanted to sort of explore that a little bit more.
I think that with my younger self, like, you know, before I was 25-ish, whatever, you know, like my early 20s, late teens, I put so much emphasis and so much of my self-worth in my results as a rider and my image as a rider. And it's something that I think it did damage me a lot. I guess I was pretty insecure as a human back then as well. I think that shows in the fact that I'm covered in tattoos, that sort of stuff. I I'm serious about that. That is a good sign if someone's covered in tattoos that they have suffered insecurity at some point, which I definitely had through my late teens, early 20s. I think that's something that I'm more than happy to admit. And it's taken a lot of work to grow from that. It's very vulnerable to say that, I think, on a live podcast, but that's fine.
Yeah, 100%.
But it's something that it's so easy to fall into the trap, you know, with the social media stuff, and you know, you're trying to portray an image that I am a excellent motocross rider.
Yeah,
like I was trying to portray that image. Like, I am, if it wasn't for these injuries, I'd be great. Or if it wasn't, you know, where in reality, it's not. I just didn't do the work and I didn't get the results. And that's something that as I've grown, you know, 25, 26, 27, I've had to look in the mirror a bit about it and be okay with the fact that, you know, I would self-sabotage, I would do all this stuff. And I think it's a lot more common in the industry than people would admit to.
I think so too.
Yeah. I would be very abrasive to people. I would say, you know, crazy things, like stuff that I don't need. You know what I mean? It's to try to portray an image or defend myself where I don't need to. Like it's, I am, yeah, I'm what I am. And it's something that, it's a life lesson learnt, not the hard way, because I think it's all turned out pretty good in the end.
Yep.
For me. But I think that a lot of people find out the hard way that you can't be that, you can't, I don't know, you can't, people see through it. They can 100% see through it and see that you're putting on a facade or a mask or whatever you want to call it. Whereas now I think that I've tried to be a bit more authentic, I guess you would
comfortable
say.
Comfortable in your own skin.
Yeah, I'm cool. Like I used to stress out if a kid was faster than me that a 3-digit number, I'd be like, what's this? Why is this happening? I'd freak out or have a moment or just be like, you know, make excuses or whatever. But I think it's something that I've grown to learn. Like even with my bike setup now, like I run coated, my forks are coated and I've got a coated shock spring, but I run stock internals. I don't valve it. I don't do anything. I just set the sag. That's it.
Yeah.
And then now I say, if my bike doesn't handle well, it's like, I need to improve.
Yes.
It's on me. It's not my bike's fault. My bike's great. I ride a CRF 450, a 2024, CRF 250, a 2024, CRF 250. Yep. The thing's great. We ride great motorcycles. There's no reason to piss and moan and complain about a clicker.
Yeah.
It's most of the time it's on you. If the sag's right, you're pretty close.
Yeah.
So I think it's something that I'd always now try to turn it on me and be like, I need to be better. I need to choose a different line. I need to fix my technique. I need to do something better than look elsewhere for blame. It's on me, which is something that I think that a lot of racers can easily get in the funk of just blaming the bike or I need to do this, I need to do that, when really it's just like it can be you.
Yeah. So when you were growing up as a racer and you said you self-sabotaged a bit, do you think that might have been to avoid that ultimate reality, 100%. The realization that you've just made now?
100%. Yeah. Yep. 100%. I would always look elsewhere for blame. I'd be like, I would roll up to the gate late. I would do all sorts of stuff to try to get a, you know, bad star or whatever it was like I said before, I would go out to a bar. I would do anything. Like it's just to never be I would never be okay with just going, all right, I'm getting to the hotel at 9. I'm going straight to bed, getting up in the morning, drinking water, having a coffee, going on the track, fresh, ready to go. That never happened.
Yeah.
I can't remember that happening.
And is that because, like, if you were to do all those things, so you were to train
and fail, I would be dead inside.
Say, yeah. Yep. You train, you eat right, you go to bed early, you do everything right, and then it doesn't work out.
I would be so hard on myself that I couldn't live with it. Like it's pretty bad. Like it's which I think that and obviously, you know, getting older and you have to at some point look yourself in the mirror and go, hey, I need to be a good person. Like I need to be a role model. I need to be able to take a loss and be okay with it. Which is something now I embrace it. Like I love that I can go to a club day, get my butt kicked by these kids coming through and be like, look how healthy our sport is. Like, look how good these kids are. Like, yeah, we're in such a good spot in this industry now where I think it's so easy to look at the negatives and, you know, oh, we not enough money for this, not enough money for that. But there's guys like yourself who are, you know, all this money for privateers, which was never around. You know, you got guys like Sid from Better by Dirt. He's putting up his own money to run a team. You know, there's so many avenues for our kids coming through to make a name for themselves, whether or not they have to work a normal job to race. That's fun. I mean, that's just life. But there's so many opportunities in this industry that I think it's so easy to get down and negative and complain. And there's 27 million people in Australia, and we got professional motocross races.
Yep.
Like it's pretty impressive. For a niche sport where you're riding a dirt bike, you go to Ride Park on the weekend, the joint's packed. You go to, you know, PBI is packed. Everywhere's packed. Everyone's riding. Everyone's in the sport. The average level of a rider now is so high. Like, it's just, we're in, the bikes are so good.
Yeah.
We're in such a good spot in this industry that I think it's very, very, and I think it's human nature that when there's no problems, you look for problems.
Yep.
And I think in the industry now, you know, you look at the Australian Supercross series is bouncing back, and you've been involved in that and you've seen that.
Yeah,
sure. I think that the motocross series will start to pick up and start to follow that trend as well. So I think that, and then you've got places like Rosebud have got their, you know, their Sandmasters series. We've got, you know, Wonthaggi AMX Opens coming up. But there's heaps of cool events and a lot of races and a lot of numbers. And yeah, it's great. We're in a good spot. I think the industry's in a really good spot.
Yeah.
And it's great to see.
Yeah, I agree. And just going back to sort of one of the things we were talking about earlier, like looking at some of these younger guys coming up, and I've got, I guess, I'd call it the benefit of having some life experience. I find it actually a little bit painful sometimes how, and I guess you suffered that same sort of mindset, they're almost like mutually exclusive. Like you can't, if you're not doing well, you can't be happy where you're at. And I wish some of these younger riders that are coming up now wouldn't beat themselves up. Like, okay, 20th or 30th might not be where you want to be, but be happy because the week before you were 35th.
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
You know, and obviously, at the end of the day, like you're racing a dirt bike, you know, on a quote professional level in Australia. Like that's pretty impressive. Like for anyone that's not in that position that loves dirt bikes, like that's such an awesome place to be. Yeah. And you can still be hungry for more.
100%.
And that's the balance. Like, so in terms of your experience and the mentality of being a racer, like how do you sort of broach that subject when you see riders doing that?
Yeah, I think it's a perspective thing. I think you're in a, you know, if you're in a position where you're getting the opportunity to go drive to Queensland to go race a national, like that's something that you'll be able to tell your kids about.
Yeah,
when that's such a great life story. Like it's such a great experience. It's something that I wish I had I could have done. Like, you know what I mean? It's something I look back and I do regret it. I wish I had a better attitude and I could have been in a position where I could have done that. But you know what? It's something that I'm okay with. That's fine. And then, but these guys coming through now, they're in such a great position that they have access to that sort of stuff. So much support, so much help along the way. I think, you know, there's different programs out there. Like, you know, your Reeves Ride Red program, you see the start gates anywhere. There's,
yeah,
10 guys on that program.
Like,
what a great program to be on. Like, how good's that? And then, you know, Yamaha are quite good with their support. KTM, all these companies go above and beyond to make sure that these guys can do it. You know, like you had Elijah on the podcast the other day. His deal with Yamaha and OTMX, and he, you know, he's cruising around riding, doing wheelies next to trains. And, you know, I mean, he can do that. And then, you know, obviously he's got a business on the side, but to be in a position where you're in that, you can do that. You have access to that sort of lifestyle. It's great. It really is great. And I think it's something that results aren't everything anymore. Like it's not, results aren't everything anymore. I think it's so important to, there are a lot, like it's very important for your own self satisfaction. If you work hard and you want to get a result, I think it's important that you try to do that. But at the same time, like whether you get 10th or 16th in a national doesn't change whether or not, you know, Gas Imports are going to support you or Faceta or whatever, you know, company, Fox even. I think what's most important is you are a good representation of these brands that, you know, and you're doing extra stuff because you need the most important part about a sponsorship, which is something I did want to touch on for a lot of young riders coming up that are trying to build relationships with these companies. You need to offer something to these companies and you need to have a relationship with these people that are, you know, writing the checks and sending the product to get anything. If you're just sending in a resume going, I got 16th at insert national here. Like they look at that and they go, well, okay. Like there's a guy that got 15th and there's a guy that got 17th. Like, well, what are they doing different? So it's very important to be able to offer, you need to offer value to these companies. Because it's, yeah, products not getting easier to come by with the price of everything now as well, and support. So it is good to be able to, yeah, do something a bit extra like what Elijah does with social media stuff. Yeah. You know, Zane McIntosh, another one of your supporter guys, he's come so far in the last 6 months with his social media presence and you know, what he's doing. And
he's really doing more with Thor and some of his sponsors now.
Yeah, Christian.
Off that base.
Absolutely. And that's great. He's offering value to these companies and he's reaping the benefits of it. He's getting the support. And that's, it's a great lesson and a great indicator of what can be done with it, you know, with a bit of an extra push. And I think what you're doing, you know, supporting these guys and giving them a platform to talk and get their stories out. It's massive. Like I'm a massive podcast listener and I can't, I don't know like you, like I go to work and I'll just listen to podcasts. I love it. I love learning about stuff. I love, you know, learning about different people's experiences and, it's just all growth, isn't it? Like it's just all about.
There's so many great stories in the sport and you can learn 100%. So much from it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can speak a little bit about or speak to, the point you just made before. Like when I put out the call for the rider support program, I did have riders that just sent me a race resume. There was no, hi, this is who I am.
Yep.
And look, to be honest, you know, the media side of things, the way I look at it, like I'm not doing news, race news or race results. It's about telling stories and bringing those stories to the public, like the riders, the personalities. So at the end of the day, like, again, if you were to look at Mental for Moto as a brand, I was way more interested in the people behind. Like, I don't care if they're coming 20th or 10th. I wanted good people.
Yeah.
And people that, you know, had a story, an interesting story, and that was a lot more important to me. And I think there is a lot of value in, it doesn't matter what brand you've got, even if it's a gear company or a shop or a dealership. Sorry, if hopefully the listeners can't hear the dog in the background going crazy. Right.
That's good, a little bit of background noise.
Yeah, fast and loose here. I think, you know, there's so much to be said of bringing that sort of value to the brands that you're representing. It's not just about race results.
Yeah, absolutely. And then another thing on that as well is it's so important and it's something that I really, really work on as well is because the industry is so small and you know, there's revolving doors and moving pieces here and there and everywhere. At some point, you're not going to be on the same program you were on last year. Yeah. But if you can get through your career without burning bridges, you'll have so much of a better result.
Yeah.
Because before you know it, you'll be back on what you're on. Because I remember through our MAD deal, I was on Peter Stevens and Fox. And I and Mick Sinclair was running that program at the time.
Yes.
The Fox program. And I lost that gig because of my bad attitude. And Mick and I, I actually reached out to Mick after his podcast with you. And I was like, man, I need to write this wrong because me and Mick had an issue. Like,
yep.
Yeah. And I saw him at Adelaide Supercross. And I went up to him and I apologized to him man to man. And we buried the bridge. And like, I'm... Yeah, and I'm obviously back with Fox now,
yep.
which is a company at that time I thought I would never be able to be back there. You know what I mean? So, it's so important not to burn bridges and try to, if you have a disagreement, you need to talk to people man to man, like the jet thing,
yep.
The same thing. It's so important to be able to not, I don't know, you need to fix wrongs. Like it's so important. And that's something that I, and Mick was great about it. He was really, really good. And I've got so much time for that dude. And he's doing such a great job with the Australian Supercross as well. So yeah, I'm stoked for the guy. And I was young and arrogant. I was just dumb. Like I was just like an idiot. I didn't really understand how the industry worked. Obviously in hindsight, it's all good. You look back and you go, man, I'm like, I'm sorry, dude. I was the worst.
And I think, you know, from what I know of Mick and the relationship that I have had with him, you know, just more recently sort of speaking to him last year, like he's a spade kind of guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like if you're up front and there's no bullshit, I think he can appreciate that, and you'll 100%. Get on fine. And
yep.
You know, that beef can be buried. So.
Yeah, absolutely. No, so yeah, you've that was on you, Pete. You sorted that one out for us. So,
oh, it's good. I had some sort of influence.
Yeah.
So
it's good, mate. I really appreciate it. Yeah, but yeah, it was, and on the Australian Supercross thing, I got to manage to go to Adelaide and Melbourne as well. And
yep,
yeah, the job they're doing is unreal. Yeah. I know that there was a lot of people talking a bit negative on Adelaide, but in the stands and at the event, yep. Mate, that was one of the best nights of racing.
Yeah,
it was awesome. Really, really good.
Yeah, I loved it there. I loved the whole setup there with the way that they had the riders start off in the crowd.
Yeah,
like for the pre-event, I guess, hype up.
Yep.
That was really cool. And you know, as much as the tracks are limited in those small stadiums, the atmosphere is just phenomenal. Like,
oh, it's great. Yep.
I wish you could get that atmosphere in somewhere like Marvel Arena. You know, it's...
Yes, for sure.
Yeah, I wonder if there's anywhere that's sort of halfway in between, you know.
I thought about that the other day. You know what would be cool? I don't know if they'd ever be able to do it, but if they ran like a strict arena cross series, like you went to like the Adelaide Entertainment Centre, Rod Laver.
Yeah.
Maybe like a three or four round series just in those entertainment centres in each capital city. Like... that would be unreal.
Yeah.
Alongside the Supercross, I don't know. I mean, obviously, we probably don't have enough people to do it, but that would be really, really cool, I think, to have like an arena cross series and a Supercross series. But you could run it through the winter or an off. Yeah, it's...
I think that racing
was so good. I mean, the 450 main event was a bit of a snoozer because just Dino checked out and that was it. But
I don't know, but
Mossy was in. Mossy
caught him at one stage and then made a couple of mistakes and dropped back again, and then he almost fell into the clutches of Brayton.
That's right. Yeah. But I don't know. I think there's market for it.
Yeah.
Because as the lighter said on the last pod, people don't want to go out to Wavell showgrounds that haven't seen Supercross before.
Yep.
As much better of a track that is, yeah, it's hard. I mean, we just don't have enough people. But if we had enough people, or we got more people in, I mean, and shows like this are going to get more people in.
Yeah.
It's simple as that.
At the end of the day, like if you look at it as a business model, having a predictable atmosphere, like the outdoor arenas or venues, like you're prone to wind and extreme heat, extreme cold. Yep. Doesn't matter what time.
Which Newcastle of the year it is. was a victim of that.
Yep, like we're in Australia, so all these things can happen. And so, if you want a predictable crowd, which is obviously going to bring the dollars to the event, and then make it a sustainable event moving forward, and you know it's going to interest sponsors and other partners, promotional partners, which in the end allows for growth. Those indoor stadiums. Perfect. Tick all those boxes.
Perfect.
And I think if you simplify the tracks a little bit, so they're not like full spec supercross style, you're going to bring, I guess, riders that are more developing those skills into it.
Yep.
But also, I think when you have simplified tracks, you don't get the gaps between the really elite guys and the guys further down, which makes for better racing. So
for sure.
As far as an event, you know, if you're trying to build something, you can make it happen. And if you have that sort of crazy bar-to-bar action, mate, you don't have to be a motocross or supercross fan to appreciate that and get a real buzz out of that sort of spectacle.
Yeah. Even the, you know, you've seen those Matt Burkeen videos.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you'd have something like that going on, like where you go to, like, maybe not, you know, these Rod Laver and that, they're quite large, but at smaller showgrounds or something like that. We get like a local arena cross thing happening, sort of like what they do at Mildura and that sort of stuff, but like an indoor one. You know, you get C grade dudes having a C grade race out there. You get B grade race. There's a bunch of classes, a lot of money made through entries as well, because you could charge $150 for an entry, and people would pay it. There's no drama, so they would love to do that to race under lights. $150 is no big deal. $200, whatever.
Yep.
You would do it to have that experience. I think anyway. Well, I would consider. I know a lot of guys that would love to do that, and then it sort of gets your feet wet a bit in Supercross, and with that, then more people go, "Oh, I'm interested in Supercross. Maybe I'll build a track. There's more places to train." It sort of all grassroots builds the whole the whole sport up, because I think that for a business model, I think Supercross is the pinnacle of the sport.
Yep.
I think that that's where the show is. That's where people are going to gravitate towards, sort of similar to how America, you know,
they want to Supercross see the elite riders as well.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's hard to get people over the line to go to, what was that Mud National in Victoria? What was that one? The real bad one.
Oh, Wodonga.
Wodonga. It's hard to get people to go to Wodonga in the mud when it's 12 degrees.
That actually didn't have a bad crowd.
Was it all right?
Yeah. And it was, we could go down a whole rabbit hole here, but they had spectator areas there that they could have just thrown some crush rock down. And look, I don't want to criticise, because from my understanding, it's the clubs that actually prepare
the
venues. And that
I think there was a mistake with the watering.
Effort and money. No, that was Appen with the mistake with the
Appen,
watering.
Right, yep. Yes.
Wodonga was the
40-degree mudder.
Yep, and Wodonga was the rain. But, like, I must say I was pretty impressed at the turnout there and the resilience of the crowd. Like, because those spectator areas started off as just grass.
Yeah.
And it ended up just being like a mud wrestling pit. and people just kept walking through and standing there, and they were knee deep in mud, and there were shoes coming off. And
it
was classic. Like, but yeah, the people still watched, and it rained throughout the day on and off.
People.
Yeah. And it actually wasn't too bad. Like, there was a good crowd and
brilliant.
And people watched the show, like loved the show. So. Yeah. That wasn't so bad in terms of that, but it's not what you want when you go into a Supercross. That's
No, definitely not. But but it's just, put those people in there, you know, a dome, and they're happy, you know, they'll go there all, you know, on Saturday night, something to do with the family. And
And sort of on that note, like being inside, at Marvel Arena, like I was down on the floor taking photos next to the track, and the perspective. Like, I've been in the crowd before in the past at Supercross, and it's so different when you're on the floor. And you probably know this yourself, like you were saying with the Firepower guys when you worked with them. When you're in the crowd, like, the crowd roars and you think you can hear the crowd, but really what you hear is the crowd around you when you're in the stand.
Yes. Yep.
When you're down on the floor, all of a sudden, like, you can hear 360 degrees. And when the crowd roars, like, it's invigorating. Yeah, it's such a different perspective, and I can only imagine for the riders, like at a place like the Adelaide Entertainment Centre or Rod Laver, like when that crowd fires up, that's just got to be like the buzz of a lifetime.
Like the sound when Parker Ross passed for the lead in the SX3 final?
Yes.
In Adelaide?
Yep.
That was crazy. That was loud and, that was in Adelaide. So, you're like you're on top of the action.
And even when Liam Atkinson passed Reese Budd in the LCQ, like just up the inside in the last corner, that was just insane.
It was a really it's a good. And then for the for Marvel, I was actually in a high end corporate box.
Yes, ooh.
But which was great. But
was that through BCP?
No. That was through my little brother's building company, Wellington Build. Shout out. So he got me up in the corporate box there with the fam, and you know what? It was great to watch it up there and catered and all that sort of stuff. But the atmosphere is not the same. Like, you're looking through these windows. It's almost like you're watching a TV show. Like, you're not involved. You're outside of the, you're outside of the experience, which is which as a to watch a show, that's great. But for me, it's like I need to be in it sort of thing. It's a bit of a different experience.
Yeah, and like, I use the example of being down on the floor, but I totally agree. At Marvel, like the atmosphere wasn't as good as Adelaide.
No.
You've got four times the amount of people.
Yeah.
But in such a big
There's so
stadium.
Much empty space, isn't it? Yeah. It's like a void. Yeah.
You know, and I went to, back in the day, I went to a UFC up in Sydney at Vodafone Arena.
Yep.
And like, the atmosphere there, it was sold out, was electric. And then I was at Marvel Arena when Ronda Rousey got knocked out. And that that was like 55,000 people there. And like, the crowd went insane when that happened, and the atmosphere still wasn't anywhere near as good as Vodafone.
As those tight arenas when you Yeah, because you're almost too far away to feel involved.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it is. You're too far away.
There's to feel a disconnect.
Like yeah, there is. Yeah, 100%. Yeah,
totally. Well, yeah, anyway, it's been awesome having you in the studio today. And, mate, I think we could just keep going.
Yeah.
So, no, I think we're going to have to definitely plan to do this again.
Yeah, it'd be great. If you're keen. Yeah, it'd be great to catch up and have another chat. It's yeah, it's an absolute pleasure, Pete. Thank you for having me, mate. And, yeah, mate, I love what you're doing. Keep up the good work. And, it's great to listen along, mate. I've listened to just about every episode. So, yeah, really enjoying it.
I appreciate it, mate. I enjoy it too. And I have to avoid saying it. Like, after every podcast that I do, I feel like, oh, that's the best one. I enjoy that more than...
Yeah.
But
as long as you say it about this one, mate, that's fine.
That's right. Yeah. But no, I've enjoyed the process too. And, you know, I love meeting new people as well. It's all pretty awesome. So, yeah, thanks again for coming in studio and look forward to doing it again.
No, absolute pleasure, mate. We'll catch up at PBI soon.
Yeah, 100%. You can give me some writing lessons.
No, I've got you, mate. Anytime you need a tip, mate, you just sing out.
Oh, good. Well, thanks, Mitch.
Also, just a quick shout-out, guys. If I can I'll have some writing schools coming up. I'll be posting on my social media as well, at MitchWorrell2020. On Instagram, and yeah, if I can, well, just give a quick shout out, or
yeah, 100%.
Yeah, sorry guys.
No, totally. Yeah,
just a quick shout out to Lee Hogan and the Building Champions program. It's an absolute pleasure, and to be doing what I'm doing, and hopefully we can keep doing it for many years to come. Fox, Michelin, Gas Imports, who else we got? Pod Knee Braces as well. Byron down there is an absolute legend. Always looking after out for me. All the guys at Lusty and ODI, Sammy at SKDA always hooks us up. Mario at Topline Seats, another great local seat supplier down in Victoria. So if you need to get a seat cover, he's your man. And yeah, thank you to all my students, my family, my kid, everyone. Yeah, thanks Pete for having me. And yeah, we'll see you soon.
Awesome. When you've got those programs coming up, send them to me via Messenger and I'll share them as well. So
will do, mate. Yeah, beautiful. That'd be great.
All good. Well, take care and we'll chat again soon.
Cheers, Pete. Thanks, mate. See ya.
And that was episode 22 with Mitch Worrell. Once again, a big thanks to Mitch for joining me in the Moto Asylum. I also have to give a big shout out to my Puggly Huxley as he put in a few guest appearances in the background on that episode. And I hope that didn't detract from the listening experience too much. If you like what we do, please make an effort to get behind our promotional partners for the podcast, as without their support, I simply could not afford to bring you this show. Graphics by Aqua, SPMX Suspension and Engine Performance, Death Grip Gloves, Works Racing, Iro, Five Gloves, Shred Bike Care, Wolf Building Compliance, and Bolt Everywhere Premium Racewear. Our next episode is going to be a race review of the AMX Open, which always produces some great racing and will no doubt give us plenty of interesting talking points as we creep ever closer to the commencement of the 2024 Promex Championship. So until then, keep your wheels pointing down and the dirt flying. This has been the Mental for Moto podcast and I've been your host, Pete Wolf. Until next time, see ya.